Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday morning, the 28th of June. It's All Things Political, always on Mondays at 9 o'clock, and Glenn Rush is our guest. Glenn covers Capitol Hill for Politico. His bio goes like this. Before that, he spent 5 years with Newsday, the last three in Washington following Hillary Rodham Clinton's highly entertaining presidential quest with a little Rudy Giuliani, Barack Obama, and Chuck Schumer thrown in. He was also working in the basement of New York City Hall, where he annoyed Mayor Michael Bloomberg. He's a veteran of Bloomberg News, former editor of City Limits, a monthly that covers low-income neighborhoods in New York, ex-editorial director of think tanks Child Welfare Watch and the Center for an Urban Future, and one-time State House and education reporter for the late great Birmingham, Alabama Post-Herald. We have a lot to talk about today. Senator Robert Byrd, the longest-serving member, he was in the House and in the Senate for 51 years, died, and we will be talking about him. Democratic-backed jobs and economic relief bill collapsed in the Senate last Thursday. We will talk more about General McChrystal and General David Petraeus and how things are going in Afghanistan. We'll look at whether or not the president is deserving of lower poll numbers. We'll, of course, look at the Gulf, the G20 summit, deficits and spending, and much more on our agenda this morning. You're welcome to join the conversation. As always, the number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and that's that. Let's meet Glenn Thrush. Hello, Glenn.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good. I'm feeling a little depressed after you, recited my entire career. It just flashed before my eyes.
But does it? Why would that make you depressed? You should be happy about it. You've done many things. Let's start with Senator Robert Byrd, who died last night at the age of 92 and was working almost right up to the end. He's a guy with he was a very important figure in the Senate. But when you read his obituary, it's amazing that he started his political career with the Ku Klux Klan. He certainly changed his mind on many issues, didn't he?
Well, it really is an extraordinary career. He is the longest serving, I guess, member of Congress in United States history. And I can tell you, I mean, when he has been sick and hospitalized several times over the past year. And each time he's returned to the Senate and typically given speeches or his famous sort of perorations from his wheelchair. And each time, I think folks in the gallery had expected sort of a diminishment of his capacity, but the guy was sharp right up until the very end. I mean, if you've got to go, that's probably the best way to go.
Yeah.
It is extraordinary. I think the last really noteworthy, well, two real legacies that Byrd has. One is sort of kind of the human embodiment of the evolution of the Democratic Party, going from, as you said, kind of like a self-educated son of a coal miner, to joining the Ku Klux Klan, probably for political purposes during the beginning of his career. And I think what was extraordinary was his steadfast resistance to the Iraq War, his vote against the war. And his second legacy is sort of a procedural in the Senate, the Byrd Rule, which a lot of folks haven't heard about, but has had an enormous impact on legislation. The Byrd Rule stipulates that amendments to appropriations and authorization bills have to be germane to the appropriation, which simply means that people can't tack anything they want onto appropriations bills, which means a lot of bad and perhaps some good pieces of legislation haven't gotten passed.
Hmm. Interesting. I love these people, too, who are totally self-educated, that he didn't go to college, but he was one of those people who took some time and studied Shakespeare and the King James Bible and remembered all of it and quoted it in his speeches.
He had just an enormous capacity. But, you know, he's really an old school senator. And I mean, I think, if I'm not mistaken, he is the only senator in U.S. history to go to law school while he was in the Senate.
Oh, my gosh.
For anyone who's an autodidact, he was a real hero.
Yes. Well, there's a lot going on this week. Let's start with confirmation hearings for Elena Kagan. Do you think she's going to sail through, or are we going to see a lot of bitterness and complaints about her from Republicans this week?
I think she is both going to sail through, and you are going to see a lot of bitterness. It's a really curious confirmation hearing. It's just been completely overshadowed by absolutely everything.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that owes to sort of the anodyne nature of her selection. She is a pretty, for someone who is being vilified as being a liberal, she's had a fairly conservative record on law and order. For instance, she, as Solicitor General, pushed the government's position in this recent ruling that came down last week on the, on not being able to support in any way, shape, or fashion this Kurdish party. So she is hardly has the record of her benefactor, Thurgood Marshall. On the other hand, the Republicans have absolutely no reason to want to go along with her. We're right in front of a potentially historic midterm for them. They're smelling blood. They have the Democrats on the run. Why not use the confirmation hearing to sort of get the base energized? So both of your assertions are right. In the end, she should pass fairly easily, but there's going to be a lot of no votes and there's going to be a ton of grandstanding.
Mm. I was listening to a news report on the way in this morning, and one senator, I can't remember who it was talking about her heroes, and we just know who she is because her biggest hero was Thurgood Marshall, of all people.
Right. I mean, she was he nicknamed her Shorty, I guess. which is indisputable. I've met her. But no, Thurgood, clearly this is a woman who, like so many in the Democratic Party, kind of came of age during the Civil Rights era. But she is, and who knows where Thurgood Marshall would be on today's court. My sense is he'd still be sort of on the left wing of the court. But, Kagan is a New Yorker, and there's a certain As a New Yorker and somebody who covered the city for basically two decades, I can tell you that there's a certain kind of New York liberal, if I could use that term,
mm-hmm.
tough on the law and order issues, acutely conscious of sort of the quote-unquote quality of life issues, but also fairly liberal on civil liberties. So she's a unique hybrid, and I think actually uniquely positioned to get through pretty quickly.
Will she have problems? Some of what we've heard is that she was much more concerned and is more concerned with partisan politics, and all we have to do is look at her time with the Clinton White House to see that that's what's motivating her.
Well, I think, the problem is the Obama folks have just been enormously careful in terms of both of their selections, Sotomayor and Elaine Kagan. Every single argument so far, with the exception of this whole issue at Harvard and not allowing military recruiters in the career office, every single issue can be answered by a Republican member of the court. If you criticize her for having pointedly political positions while she was in the Clinton administration, you immediately turn to the records of Justice Roberts and Justice Alito, who had equally partisan briefs and memos that they did when they were in the Reagan and Bush administrations. So you could sort of cut them off at the pass on that. The other big argument that we saw as sort of the first argument that Republicans put forward was that she had no bench experience. And then there's a simple two-word answer for that is William Rehnquist, a guy who also didn't have a minute of bench experience. So it seems to me that you kind of winnow through those arguments fairly quickly. The point here is anything can pop up in one of these hearings. She could say something stupid. One of the senators can say something stupid. And I think that's a little known sort of factor in these hearings. We pay a lot of attention to what the nominee is saying.
Right.
But a lot of the senators who approach her, particularly on the Republican side, on the opposition side, can also make mistakes and totally change the nature of this hearing. I remember with Sotomayor, John Cornyn, the senator from Texas, a state with a large and growing Hispanic population, initially joined in on the chorus of criticisms of Sotomayor on various issues, including the wise Latina comment. But he got a bit of a backlash back home from Hispanic groups, and he backed off. And that was a really critical factor in the ease with which Sotomayor was confirmed.
Let's talk about Hispanic groups for a moment and how large a factor they may be in these midterm elections. This Arizona law has a lot of people furious, and now other states are trying to have laws similar to Arizona. What about this? Is it going to change the complexion of the election?
I don't think it's going to change the complexion of the election. I think it has actually changed the complexion of the election with John McCain in the Republican primary in Arizona against J.D. Hayworth. You know, McCain, who was a staunch supporter of immigration reform, including the path to citizenship, which conservatives refer to as amnesty, rightly or wrongly, has really abandoned his support of comprehensive immigration reform, at least during this time period. So that's really shifted the Senate to a certain extent to the right on immigration reform. It's also, you know, the Arizona law is also enormously popular among a broad swath of Americans, according to the polls we're seeing. The question remains, will it motivate people to go to the polls who would otherwise not go to the polls? And my sense is on the conservative base, immigration has always been red meat, but it's always been a little, when you speak with Republican consultants, it's never really panned out as a major campaign issue. And I think people like Karl Rove and George W. Bush and Dick Cheney understood that the short-term benefits of pushing this issue redound to the long-term harm of the Republican Party, which is going to need to court Hispanics. So I think it's a decidedly mixed bag. I don't think it's going to be a huge motivating factor in terms of getting Democratic turnout, however.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Rolling Stone and General McChrystal. Are we reading all the wrong publications now, and foremost on our list should be publications like Politico and Rolling Stone, because that's where the real news is?
Are you saying that we're like Rolling Stone? I was a spin reader when I was a kid. No, it's funny because Rolling Stone was enormously relevant in the 72 election when Hunter Thompson was writing,
yes,
for an entirely different reason, right? They sort of redefined new journalism, sort of pushed the outer envelope. But look, I've been a reporter for a while. I've taught journalism, and I can tell you right now, if you have a talented, motivated reporter who has good access, good sources, and has an editorial backing, any reporter can break any story at any given time. And that's kind of what is so frustrating about being in the mainstream media, and is so frustrating in general about trying to follow the mainstream media. You never know where the big story is going to come from. And yeah, I just think it's terrific that we're just that they've renewed their franchise. But it also points to this other factor, right? Large news organizations, you know, with the possible exception of the Times, to a lesser extent, the Washington Post, cannot devote the resources to allow a reporter to spend 1, 2, 3, 4, 6 months working on a story, developing sources and relationships. And the outlets that give people that sort of latitude and support are going to break these kinds of stories.
It's interesting, and you wrote this in Politico, that we've got Obama replacing him with General David Petraeus, the mastermind of an Iraq surge that Obama did not support, and the man many Republicans want to challenge Obama for the White House in 2012.
Yeah, good luck with that. I think that's a huge, to me, that's been a huge canard for a while. Petraeus, I know people who know Petraeus. Petraeus is not temperamentally inclined to want to campaign, is my sense. Now, I could be, you know, I've said that about other people who've thrown their hat into the ring, but and when you look at the recent history of generals who have sort of thrown their hat into the political arena post Eisenhower, it's pretty thin gruel. And the other thing about Petraeus is he's just a soldier, and the rapidity with which he accepted this assignment. Think about this: the guy was living in Tampa. Granted, he's got the weight of the world on his shoulders, but he's now having to leave his family in Tampa to take up residence,
yes,
in Kabul, Afghanistan. I think Petraeus is keen on trying to implement this policy that he himself crafted. He wants to use Afghanistan as a bit of a laboratory for his counterinsurgency strategy, and I think there really was, in retrospect, no other guy who could have replaced McChrystal. You know, Petraeus wrote the McChrystal plan. McChrystal has been the person who has implemented it on the ground. But this, make no mistake about it, this sort of surge you know, the take and hold strategy and the notion of sort of winning over the civilian population is vintage Petraeus.
Right. Well, things are not going well in Afghanistan. That's an understatement. What's going to change it? This is a long time now, 9 years.
You know, that's the $100 billion question, right? I think the interesting thing about covering the McChrystal blow-up last week, and the thing that really surprised me, was the lack of real institutional support for the Afghanistan war. You know, President Obama made a much ballyhooed speech last December at West Point, in which he sort of laid out the notion that we were going to have a temporary surge of 30 to 40,000. It was the first time he put forth this July 2011 date for beginning to withdraw. And it really sort of put Afghanistan a bit on the back burner, despite some of these flare-ups. But when the McChrystal thing broke, you know, I made a lot of calls around. I spoke to a bunch of folks on the Hill, including some folks in the White House. And the sense of support for this war, the sense of, this open-ended timetable is really eroding rapidly. You know, the public has turned against this. I think people are losing a sense of the connection between what's going on with the Karzai government and stopping Al-Qaeda. The time window, the president may think he has a lot of time on this. I don't think he does. And there's one other factor here. President Obama's popularity among the base has taken a really big hit, obviously, over the past year and a half to 2 years. Based on a lot of these compromises he's made on these big-ticket legislative items, particularly the public option and health care reform. The president, and I covered the 2008 campaign from the vantage point of traveling around with Hillary Clinton, and I can tell you that the vast majority of people who turned out for Obama rallies and the greatest part of the enthusiasm for him as a candidate was predicated. Its foundation was on his opposition to the Iraq war.
Yes.
You now have a president who has doubled down on a war that is becoming increasingly unpopular, and that is sapping his support among the base. I think that is a relatively sort of underappreciated dynamic here. The Afghanistan war is costing President Obama support among Democrats, and I think that is a strongly motivating factor for why he is going to need to come to some sort of resolution by that between now and July next year.
And what resolution would that be? To withdraw support for Afghanistan? To remove troops? I mean, nothing is moving ahead here. You got a government that's kind of corrupt. You've got opium at an all-time high. You've got the Taliban resurgent. What do you do?
Well, what are you asking me for? I don't know. I mean, far wiser heads than I have examined this problem. I thought Tom Friedman had an interesting take in the Times on Friday, where he said that when Petraeus attacked the problem in Iraq with the surge and sort of made Baghdad more or less a more livable city than it was, he was making a statement about democratizing in a major Middle Eastern capital, that this would actually really have a ripple effect. By taming Afghanistan, Friedman asserted, you tame Afghanistan, that it is such a unique outlier, which is one of the reasons why Al-Qaeda thrived there in the first place. So the question is, even if you achieve what you take a victory lap and achieve what you believe is a sustainable result, is it really a sustainable result, or is Afghanistan going to be Afghanistan whether you were there or not? So, my sense is that we're going to be there for quite a while. We're going to have a support position, but we're going to have a real pivot point in sometime next summer in which we determine just how much we want to be in. And my sense is, even with bolstered Republican majorities and minorities or potential majorities in both houses, there's not a tremendous appetite to spend these billions and billions of dollars there.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk just a little bit about politics here, because midterms are coming up and it won't be all that long before the president is running for re-election. I want to spend some time on those poll numbers, which have dropped for him. There were some interesting letters to the editor in yesterday's Times talking about liberal support waning for him, partially because they see him aligned with Wall Street, partially because of Afghanistan, partially because they thought he was going to be a great progressive president and then he's become more centrist. There are others who say he has to be centrist. interest. This is not a liberal country. He's got to govern from the middle here. And also that he's not able to get much done because you don't have the 60 votes here, so that there's a threat of filibuster all the time, no matter what the issue is. Where's the truth on this? What does he need to be concerned about, and how can he govern more effectively?
Well, I think, you know, he's in a real box here. I mean, to a certain extent, the exigency and just the proliferation of crises in, in the fall of 2008 exaggerated, I think, the support for Democrats in general. I mean, we saw a poll, I forgot who did it, out over the weekend, that had people self-identifying themselves, 40% of the population self-identifying themselves as conservative, and something like 25% self-identifying themselves as liberal. Now, granted, there's a lot of that has to do with sort of branding of both of those terms. But I really do think he is confronting the same reality that Bill Clinton confronted nearly 20 years ago, and that is, you know, Democrats rent the White House. To a certain extent, Republicans own it just by sheer numbers at the moment. So, what can he do? I think the wedge that he is caught in between here is he is faring most poorly among white independents, and of that subgroup, not surprisingly, among male white independents. So you're going to see the White House, and you have continued to see the White House attempt to really address the concerns of those groups and sort of build up his support among white female independents, which is considered to be also a pretty heavy swing group. The other area, and this is really fascinating, where he's having tremendous trouble in making headway, is getting the base re-energized. After 18 months, I mean, you look at the level, and this is, you know, an objective view of this, whether you like the president or not, you can't deny that he has achieved an enormous amount legislatively. I mean, the stimulus alone was a huge, for good or for ill, accomplishment for the White House. The health care reform, again, for good or for ill, was a huge accomplishment. He's going to pass regulatory reform. We, you know, left in the shadows is this Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, and none of these accomplishments have done a lick to energize his base. In fact, you know, the sausage-making process involved in this has eroded his brand considerably among his base. So he's got this, like, dual problem of trying to figure out how to sort of get white independents back and energize the base. And I can tell you, the issues that you need to get one tend to alienate the other. So he's got quite a challenge on his hands.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls. Glenn Thrush is our guest this hour of the program. He is a Capitol Hill reporter for Politico, and we're welcoming calls on a wide range of topics. We've just brought up a few. Feel free to bring us into new territory or comment on what we've already discussed. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. To your calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, and let's start with Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. I want to talk today about Afghanistan con games. And I start by saying that if you look in the net under Afghanistan pipeline, UNICAL, there's plenty of information there that might give you some hints of things that are going on. But in the more current context, in today's Milwaukee Journal, Panetta is saying that we haven't had any intelligence on Osama bin Laden for years, but the inference has been, even by the president, that he's still alive, in spite of the fact that we've killed half of the higher command in of Al-Qaeda. They still, quotes, can't find him. Secondly, the whole argument is made that, if we don't go over there and stop them over there, that somehow they're going to come over here. They're going to be able to plan operations that happen over here. But if you think about it, Al-Qaeda is all over the place in the world, Yemen, Somalia, the Philippines, all over the place. And so the core issue is not whether what we do over there, it's what we do at home to prevent anybody from coming over here. Thirdly, the mineral items have come to attention, and I would encourage people to look under Afghanistan Minerals on the net, and page to the second page where it has a story, vast stores of minerals, quote, suddenly found in Afghanistan. And some of the points that come out of this, the idea is that if we would leave Afghanistan, that the Taliban would then use these minerals and exploit them and be able to use them to wage war against us. And they talk about all sorts of interesting things. Like, for example, that if you search through the first two pages of this in the net, that you can find that these minerals were not just recently discovered, that we knew about them way back to the 70s, but we weren't able to exploit. They weren't able to exploit them because of the difficulty in connecting rail transportation in the country. And it points out that if we were to exploit these resources, that with roadside bombs, they could use them to destroy the railways in Afghanistan, keep us from getting the minerals out. But they don't also point out that that if the Taliban, if we left Afghanistan completely and the Taliban took control, they'd still have to run a railway network to get the minerals out. And of course, we could bomb completely bomb the rail network through the drone planes and other planes. So, you know, again, it's a hyped-up issue to justify keeping us in Afghanistan.
Glenn, it's yours. Go ahead.
Well, I think, you know, I think you reflect a growing sense among a lot of people that this, you know, a growing question as to why exactly we're there. I heard it was really interesting. I think John McCain was on Meet the Press, and John McCain is obviously a pretty big supporter of the war in Afghanistan. In fact, he was the guy who was questioning General Petraeus about it when General Petraeus fainted a couple of weeks ago. And he was really struggling to answer that question as well. I think sort of the old linkage between Al-Qaeda, considerably with the degrading of their senior leadership, you know, making the linkage between Al-Qaeda and Afghanistan is a is increasingly becoming difficult. So I don't think the administration has a good answer to your question at the moment.
Thanks very much, Jim, for the call. Cliff in Appleton, hi. Hello, Cliff.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead. Cliff, if you want to talk, now's your time. I don't know where he is. I want to spend some time talking about jobs before we go back to phone calls. A recent piece in Politico talks about the swelling number of jobless workers, 1.2 million without unemployment benefits. And then we had this Democratic-backed jobs and economic relief bill, which collapsed, the article says, in the Senate on Thursday after failing for the third time to break through a wall of Republicans who rejected repeated entreaties to join in advancing the $100 billion-plus package. This is another issue that has made his supporters disaffected, I think. And why is it so difficult to take on this issue, which is, you know, just a bread and butter issue to people in this country who need work?
I think this is, I agree with you. I think this is an enormous issue, and it's going to have enormous political implications. Look, the Obama administration, to some extent, has been a victim of their own success on this thing. It's hard to define a 10% national unemployment rate as successful, but it is when you look at the context of potentially a 15 or 18% unemployment rate, which is what people were predicting before the stimulus was passed. You now have Republicans in Congress blocking a long-term extension of unemployment insurance. A clear delineation between the two parties on this issue as you have seen in years. No one's really talking about it right now, but I can guarantee that during the election, this is an issue that Democrats are going to pound away on. To a certain extent, this is a point that Joe Biden makes. A lot of the impact of the stimulus has been in job retention and an extension of these benefits programs. So you haven't seen the floor come out from underneath people. I guess there's an estimate that the American Federation of Teachers is putting out that, you know, we're going to see potentially the loss of 200,000 teachers nationwide. When the stimulus expires, you know, even if that's an exaggeration by a union, a loss of half that much would be devastating to local communities. So the Republicans are allied with sort of the internationally what we call the Merkel camp, the Merkel-Cameron axis, in terms of wanting to cut these huge deficits. And we saw at the G20 in Toronto this weekend, President Obama sort of tepidly endorsing this long-term deficit reduction goal internationally. But, there is a real belief and a real separation that's occurring right now between the two parties in this country and sort of two parties internationally, between the notion that you need to keep these supports, both in terms of stimulus and in terms of benefits, and a sense among Republicans that you need to attack the deficit. I think in terms of the economy, those are the two trenches that are drawn for the midterms.
And as a result, people can't find work. They're unemployed and, you know, they can't make house payments, and it's a mess.
Oh, it's unbelievable. I mean, you know, even us cloistered reporters here inside the Beltway have families outside the Beltway. And, you know, you're talking about people with college degrees, advanced college degrees, who are having to take jobs, you know, outside of their fields for pay that's 20, 30, 40% below of what they were making. Right. I mean, we're talking about a significant economic restructuring in this country, and people are really hurting. And, you know, the president has not been able to sort of answer that. I don't think any president could answer that. You know, there's going to be a big political fallout. It's not exactly clear how this stuff's going to play out, though.
Now we will try Cliff again in Appleton. Hi, Cliff.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to take issue with the characterization that Obama's accomplishments have not energized his base. I and many people I know are extremely proud of his accomplishments with the stimulus package that saved the financial system from collapse after the excesses of the Bush era, you know, from health care reform, his response in the Gulf. You know, we are aware that there are many vocal but misguided Americans who seek to blame him for everything, including things he's not responsible for. But just wait until he starts to campaign, because all these attacks on him, oh, we remember everything. Just wait. You think this base is not energized? You think again.
So well, you know, I appreciate your enthusiasm, but I can tell you that the attitude in the White House is worried about energizing the base. You know, this is not something that we're, you know, is not something that pundits are simply opining. I mean, you know, there are groups a couple of weeks ago, I guess in early in early June, there's a pretty big meeting of progressives. It was kind of a primal scream against against, you know, some of the president's policies, especially the public option and also Afghanistan. And the poll numbers show that the base is not energized, and organizations that Obama was really counting on, OFA being principal one, Organizing for America, which is sort of his campaign, you know, in the lull year, have just not been seeing the same sort of enthusiasm that they had seen in years past. So, you know, a lot of this is to be expected. The 2008 campaign was a singular moment in history. He was a singular candidate. And obviously people are going to be disappointed by the mundane, grinding, ugly business of governance. And as soon as we get to 2012, they might sort of come back to him. But at the moment, I can tell you, it isn't just reporters and pundits who are noticing this trend. It's the people around Obama.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Cliff, for your call. And let's spend some time talking about grinding issues. The Gulf, which is into what, day number 64. And you can't help, if you watch nightly news, which, you know, I do every night, to see this story lead every night for 64 days, and all the animals and all the people who are crying, who have lost their businesses and no relief in sight, and just relentless bad news, which has been tied, rightly or wrongly, to the way he is handling all of this. Some of it, of course, is out of his control. But it's a horrendous story, Glenn.
Yeah, and it just doesn't stop, and there's not a lot.
Right.
And there's not a lot the president can do to pivot from it. You know, they had a political victory last week when Congressman Joe Barton of Texas planted oily foot firmly into mouth and said that apologized to BP for this $20 billion compensation fund that the White House had established. You know, that took the pressure off them for a couple of days, but. You know, this is not a drip. This is a millions of gallons a week that are coming out into the Gulf. Joe Biden's going back to the Gulf. Is going to the Gulf, I think, for his first trip this week. You know, we're talking about maybe mid August until this is finally dealt with. I just don't really think that there's particularly a way out politically for the administration on this, apart from plodding ahead and accelerating reform. So I can tell you that the sense of concern over there, both with the environmental damage and the political damage at the White House, is extraordinary. In fact, during the first week that this happened, a senior administration official said to me that they felt that, you know, they were in a little bit of a panic about this, just in terms of you know, grappling with the magnitude and what it could do in terms of derailing the president's larger agenda. So, you know, I think finding a way out of this is extraordinarily difficult.
Right. And I think that you had a piece recently talking about how the White House took on the Barton comments immediately and tried to use them as a way to align Republicans with big business and align them with big oil companies, et cetera. Was that just a short-lived thing? Because all of a sudden he was roundly criticized? Or is this something that the Democrats will store away and use again?
Well, it's funny. You know, a lot of people sort of criticize reporters and Politico in particular for sort of focusing on these short-term political issues, namely the White House seizing upon, Barton's comments and sort of using it to sort of delineate Democrats from Republicans. But for the White House, this is a really fundamental issue. They got to get the politics of this right to be able to proceed with the policy. And they really need to demonize the Republicans who have just scored tremendous points on them. I mean, you know, you're talking about Senate seats that could be won or lost based on this stuff. So, it's not surprising. Mike Allen and myself reported that the White House really wanted to keep the Barton thing alive for a couple of extra days, and they sort of coached Joe Biden, the vice president, to go in front of the media. You don't have to really prod Biden very much to to talk to reporters, but at the highest levels, I think they understand that they need to do something to take the initiative here.
Let's go to Jake from La Crosse. Hi, Jake.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I just wanted to call in and, just voice my opinion here. I just really feel that Obama, it's Jimmy Carter number two all over again. Very disappointed in him from the handling of the Gulf, but I want to talk about jobs, as you guys were talking about a minute ago. I have a neighbor that's been on unemployment now for 2 years.
Oof.
And he's been collecting unemployment. I guarantee you, he's not the only one. There's millions of Americans that are out there that have been collecting unemployment. The other day when I asked him, I told him, I go, with Walmart DC's hiring, it's like $14, $15 an hour. It's not the greatest job in the world, but you know what? It's a job. So why don't you go and apply there? And he said, well, why would I do that? I'll lose my unemployment. And, I just get so frustrated. I'm a hardworking American. I go to, I work 55 hours a week. I pay my taxes. And you see all these other Americans. There are jobs out there. Whether or not they want to go out and work them is another story. I have six kids. I have to be working, to support my family. But for all these people out there, they're collecting unemployment and are not searching for, jobs, or they don't want to get a job just because it's not paying what they used to. Well, tough kitty. That's just stupid. And my frustration level with the Democrats here on how they just want to pander to the poor and just, go for their votes. They think they're entitled to all these entitlements. And it's got me mad. It's got all the people I work with upset because I talk about it with my friends and my coworkers. And enough already.
Can I interrupt for a second?
Yeah, please. Go ahead, Glenn.
Where are you getting this information that all this money is going to poor people?
Say what?
Where are you getting this information that all this money, and the stimulus stuff is being directed at the poor?
Well, the stimulus money is going to 100% pretty much is going to the jobs that are being created are all government jobs, which that's a whole other story.
No, that's not the case. A very small proportion of the stimulus jobs are government jobs. Most of them are farmed out to local contractors and pre-existing contracts with folks, and very few of them are going to poor people. They're going to working class folks, and they're going to construction trades. I don't know the breakdown, but factually, it's just not correct. But it is interesting to note that people have that perception. I think like 6%, the stimulus has a 6% approval rating around the country. But I'm just curious to know why is it you think that this is being directed at the poor?
But a lot of this money, I'm talking specifically about the unemployment benefits. I know a lot of people out there that are unemployed and they refuse to go get a job.
Okay, I think you made that point. I don't think there are enough jobs. If you look at what the number of people who are applying for one position, it's phenomenal. If you look at teacher layoffs, if you look at white collar worker layoffs and blue collar worker layoffs, they're just, you look at students who can't find summer work. I don't think there's an abundance of jobs. Maybe I'm wrong about this, Glenn.
No, there's and particularly on the, you mentioned the student thing. I mean, there are no jobs for young people graduating college. I mean, you have, you know, I see it in journalism. You sort of
yes,
see a lot
too.
Of sort of permanent interns.
Right,
permanent
right.
unpaid interns who are sort of hoping that the cycle changes. And you know, I have a close relative of mine who is college educated and was working as a professional who is now working as a stock clerk in a Best Buy. I mean, it is an absolutely dreadful situation. But the other thing I want to take issue with, and I'm not defending Obama per se, but the comparison between Obama and Jimmy Carter, I think, is a spurious one. I mean, Jimmy Carter, not to belabor the point, but in two major aspects, I think it's untrue. Jimmy Carter did not have anywhere near the substantial record of legislative accomplishment that Obama has. And to further that point, he also had just a hideous relationship with Democrats in Congress where he was simply not able to get anything done. So, you know, the Carter comparison, I think, you know, is one that the White House is worried about, but I also think the facts don't support it at the moment.
You know, and on the other hand, the president is also perhaps rightfully being criticized for not creating a lot of government jobs, for not putting people back to work, which may stimulate the economy.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, I guess his most pointed critic in that regard is Paul Krugman of the Times, who is sort of referring to this as the second great long depression in American history, comparable to one in the late 19th century. We did see this massive, I guess the unemployment report last month showed that the vast majority of jobs was created on the short term and in the census. And if you look, if you know your history of the New Deal and look at sort of FDR's approach, it was almost entirely predicated on public sector employment. And there are a lot of economists who fault the president for sort of doing this pass-through stuff with contractors and localities and not grabbing the bull by the horns and having the federal government be the employer of last resort. I think it's a really lively debate, but I think it's all sort of eclipsed by this much larger conflict between those who think we still need more stimulus and those who think that we need to start attacking the debt.
We welcome more phone calls for Glenn. And we'll do that in just one moment. Glenn is the Capitol Hill reporter for Politico and has written a number of articles recently about jobs and Elena Kagan and Petraeus and McChrystal and all of that. Glenn Thrush, our guest. And here's our number. We have one line open at 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program, we've talked about this issue before, but we're going to see what progress they have made. We'll talk with two people who are involved in this massive project to organize and make available on the internet virtually all information about life that is present on Earth. They've discovered, of course, since they've been doing this, some new species, and they also have been paying special attention to what's going on in the Gulf, making us aware of all of the animals living in the Gulf and those that have been threatened as a result of this environmental disaster. All things political this hour. We continue with your phone calls. Glenn Thrush is with us, Capitol Hill reporter for Politico. Mike in Appleton, hello.
Yeah, good morning. Two quick comments. First on the job issue. Look, I'm a small micro businessman, but I have the potential of hiring a couple of people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's millions of people like me. The trouble is that there's just a lack of confidence. I think my perception is, hey, there's too much going on. Things are not clear. You know, what taxes are coming down the road? Am I going to go out and hire somebody in this situation? I don't think so. And I think that echoes itself across the country. And so, you know, you talk about all of these political accomplishments, but in reality, it's created a lot of unease and let's wait and see. And, you know, if you haven't been in business yourself, or you haven't run a business, you haven't had to meet a payroll, you probably don't know what I'm talking about, but there's a lot of people out there like me who are thinking like this. That was the first point I'd like to make.
All right, let's take them one by one. Glenn?
Well, I am the son of not to get too autobiographical, but I am the son of a small business owner, and what the caller says is interesting because it actually runs counter to what you hear from sort of labor and employment experts who aren't always right about these things, but they say that the labor pool that's out there because of of so many people being axed from lucrative jobs is actually pretty good, and you're getting. And I've heard instances in which you have, in which I've known people who are looking for folks relatively low-level jobs in which they've gotten 20, 30 applications, and 10 of them are people who are overqualified. So, I think the problem's more on that end.
Your other point, Mike?
The other point was with this McChrystal. McChrystal's a smart guy, and I think everybody's, confused as to why he let this happen. I just wonder if he did it on purpose to maneuver Obama into the position that they have him in now.
That's a really interesting perspective. And it wouldn't have been the first time that McChrystal did such a thing. Last year in London, he gave a speech that a lot of people and sort of leaked the numbers on the surge, and a lot of people think that kind of forced Obama's hands on that. I don't think McChrystal or anyone else in their right mind would have gone down like it did, but Petraeus, the author of this doctrine, now has ownership of this. So, I think we are we not to use the cliche. I can't think of any other cliche, but he has doubled down on this, and Petraeus has ownership of this. So, we're going to see whether or not this surge strategy works in Afghanistan.
Thanks, Mike. Andrew in Madison. Hi.
Hi, maybe echoing one of the calls earlier, I think, Cliff, that I'm very much in Obama's base, a liberal academic in my 30s, and have just found myself really happy with Obama and a lot of things that he's been doing. I recognize it's a really complex and difficult situation, especially with losing the filibuster proof and filibuster and everything. So I wanted to express that sentiment. But this morning, hearing Robert Byrd's speech just around the Iraq War, he was sort of attacking the Bush administration for taking over government and big government, all these things. And it struck me that so many of the attacks are really circular. They're the same attacks you hear again and again, sort of to both administrations. And I just wondered if your guests could comment on how much of what we're seeing in the attacks on Obama and the situation right now are things that you see in sort of circular patterns, or things that are really, truly unique and original to the current administration.
Well, that's an interesting point. I think a lot of these are circular and kind of evergreens. But the president now has a record to run on, and there is a palpable sense of disappointment in the way that he has approached things, sort of trying to be a lot of things to a lot of different people. So I think I think a lot of this stuff is cyclical. Some of this stuff is sort of thoughtless, but. But, when you look at criticism of the president's initial response and his team's initial response to the Gulf oil spill, I think, there are demonstrably things that he could have done better. And you're also starting to see emerge a certain management style from the president. On the upside, it's this capacity to micro-focus and in a very short period of time, achieve a tremendous grasp of the complexities of any situation. The downside of that, the flip side, is that if he is not focused on something, the level of sort of his command control of things tends to slip. And he wasn't initially focused, regardless of what a lot of the White House folks say, on the oil spill when it started.
No, he wasn't. And he's a very, very savvy guy. He's a really smart guy, I think, and it sometimes is amazing that he steps in late to so many issues. And then he tells you later, listen, I've been working on this since day one, and here's what I've done, but we don't know what he's done.
No, and that's the thing. I mean, and to a certain extent, it's a problem stemming from his talent, right? This is a guy, it doesn't take him a long time to come up to speed on stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a tremendously confident person, and his sense is that he can move quickly into any crisis as it pops up. And he has proven to be enormously flexible on this stuff. But a lot of government, and let's not forget, neither Obama nor most of the folks in his inner circle have any real executive experience. So in terms of running the largest bureaucracy in the history of the world,
right.
He's very much learning on the job.
Thanks, Andrew. We have time for one more phone call. Brad is next. Hi, Brad.
Hi there. I wanted to mention a Tea Party consultant wrote a magazine article this month revealing right-wing marketing strategies, and he said, quote, we're playing to the reptilian brain rather than the logic centers. So we look for keywords and images to leverage the intense rage and anxiety of white working class conservatives. In other words, I talk to the same part of your brain that causes road rage. And I thought that was very revealing on his part as to the simplified smears and slogans that they use that aren't based in fact.
Glenn.
I think a lot of this actually stems from people like Drew Weston and George Lakoff, who talked about these buzzwords. And I guess the part of the brain we're talking about is the amygdala, which sort of controls the fear impulse. And there was an interesting study about this, I guess, about a year ago that sort of talked about how people who have a hyperactive amygdala tend to be more conservative. But I can tell you right now, the Democrats would love to capture the reptilian part of people's brains, too. And while you see this sort of concerted effort on the part of the right, I can tell you Democrats are working their focus groups just as energetically to sort of find issues that sort of tickle, you know.
They just don't know how to do it very well, do they? Yeah. Glenn, thank you so much. We've had a lot of all things political guests, and you rank way up there. You're just a great guest. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
Glenn Thrush, Capitol Hill reporter for Politico, our guest this hour. He, before working with Politico, spent 5 years with Newsday, the last three in Washington, following Hillary Rodham Clinton's presidential quest. He has covered Rudy Giuliani, President Barack Obama, and Chuck Schumer as well. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. You can read, of course, Glenn's columns, and he is a very prolific writer at Politico.com. Thanks for all of your calls, everybody. Sorry we didn't get to all of them. We were busy this morning. There's a lot going on. We have another hour following the news coming up in a moment.